Hello, this is Martin Sheen, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
I'm Amy Castellum. Today, we're revisiting a story we first published in 2023. It's about criminalized survival, or how survivors of intimate partner violence become entangled in and punished by the criminal justice system.
And I was like, wait, like, we're putting women and survivors in prison for fighting for their own lives.
That's journalist and survivor Natalie Patillo. Together, she and cinematographer Daniel Nelson made the award-winning documentary film, And So I Stayed. We interviewed them last year, and today we're sitting down with Natalie again. There is a lot to catch up on. A lot of it is good. Stay with us. I'm Amy Castellum. You're listening to Making Contact. Today's show is a powerful story of solidarity and response to the problem of intimate partner violence. Please take care when you're listening today. Now to our interview with reporter Natalie Patillo. Hey, girl, hey.
Hey.
So, Natalie, just to recap for our listeners, your film, And So I Stayed, follows three women's stories. Tanisha Davis, Nikki Adamando, and Kim Dadu Brown all were sentenced to many years in prison after actions they took to protect themselves from their abusers, which resulted in their deaths. The film follows these women, but it also follows the fight to get a law passed in New York that would give hope to people like Kim, Nikki, and Tanisha, who have been incarcerated after surviving domestic violence. It's called the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act, or DVSJA. Can you summarize what the DVSJA does?
The DVSJA allows judges to look at domestic violence as a significant contributing factor to a crime. So it works in two ways. Folks can be sentenced under the law, which means less harsh sentencing. And then it can also be used for folks who are currently incarcerated and the crime predated this law's existence. So then they're able to potentially get out earlier than their original sentencing.
So Natalie, in your film, we learned that Tanisha was able to use this law on appeal to get her sentence reduced, that retroactive sentencing we were talking about. And so the third woman in the film, Nikki Adamando, was tried and sentenced after the DVSJA passed. But here's the thing, the judge in her case didn't really seem to consider the new law. The judge sentenced her to 19 years to life in prison, which is like not a reduction at all. And so in the end of your film, is really heartbreaking because Nikki is still at Bedford Hills and her sister Michelle is raising Nikki's kids and fighting to get her sister's sentence reduced. But a lot has happened since then, right? For one thing, Nikki is out.
Nikki is out. The case thankfully went to the appellate court, and the appellate court did think she was eligible. So they were able to use the law in Nikki Adamando's case and say, actually, she does qualify. She is eligible for the DVSJA, and she did get a sentence reduction.
Right. So now that Nikki's out, she has been advocating for laws similar to the DVSJA. Here's some audio from an Instagram post that she made with her sister, Michelle Horton, in March. They are cozied up on the sofa in their living room.
As you know, the only reason I'm home right now is because of the DVSJA. So a law passing like this in Oklahoma would have the potential to help hundreds of incarcerated survivors.
And the survivors in Oklahoma really need this. We were told that Oklahoma has the highest rate of domestic violence in the country and also the highest number of incarcerated women. Obviously, those two things go hand in hand. So what we need to do right now is to encourage Oklahoma senators to say yes to Senate Bill 1470.
Okay, so update here to this Oklahoma law. Girl, it passed. So how did it feel to watch this law pass in Oklahoma?
I mean, honestly, of all states, like, to be frank, it just doesn't come to mind as like Oklahoma will be next. But the organizers in Oklahoma have worked very hard.
So yeah, so I talked to Alexandra Bailey to get some more information about this. She is a senior campaign strategist with the Sentencing Project. They advocate for effective and humane responses to crime that minimize imprisonment and criminalization of youth and adults by promoting racial, ethnic, economic, and gender justice. Okay, so Ms. Bailey, who is also a survivor of domestic violence, has been working hard on this Oklahoma bill. And she said what really motivated her to pursue this law was a Mother Jones article she read about a case in Oklahoma highlighting failure to protect laws, which is one of the ways that survivors get entangled by the criminal justice system, right? Can you explain failure to protect laws?
Right. So a survivor could be with a partner who is abusive. That abusive partner could cause harm to a child. And just because the survivor might not be able to leave or was just present whenever the abuse took place, those failure to protect laws can cause these survivors to be criminalized. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense, and it'll never make sense to me.
Well, you're not the only one. Here's Alexandra Bailey talking about the Mother Jones article that she read.
And it highlights one particular case about a woman who was in a terrible domestic violence situation that could have taken her life. And her children attempted to intervene. And one of them got pushed out of the way and hurt themselves. And she went to prison for that. And the even more ironic part is that or terrible part, I guess I should say, is that her children were given to her ex-partner, who had already spent multiple years in prison for committing domestic violence against her. So just
it's baffling.
Utterly
it doesn't
ridiculous.
Make any sense.
Yeah, just you can't, it's like you eat too much ice cream and your brain no longer functions.
So this was 2022, and in this Mother Jones article, Alexandra saw Colleen McCarty's name. She's the executive director of the Oklahoma Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. They connected, Alex secured funding, and together they created a coalition to write a law that used New York's DVSJA as a template. The coalition included representatives from tribal nations because Oklahoma is Indian country. That means that there's various legal conditions to consider. And it is worth noting that Indigenous American women are the group that experiences the most intimate partner homicide in the United States.
And the great thing is that we've been in lockstep with incarcerated women from the beginning.
Word. So they had a few false starts in the legislature, but in the end, Alex told me that this bill
flies through the state legislature. I mean, just flies. It goes through committee, unanimous vote. It goes to the other committee, unanimous vote. It gets to the floor of the Senate, unanimous vote. It transfers to the floor of the House, 3 no votes. Unheard of in Oklahoma.
Were you surprised?
At those numbers, at unanimous in Oklahoma?
Right.
I don't think you could get a unanimous vote on saving the dolphins.
My mom's people are from Oklahoma, so like.
Yeah.
I noticed that part of the new law, just like New York's DVSJA, says that there has to be a high burden of proof. Mm-hmm. And this has been an issue for survivors. So the latest National Domestic Violence Hotline survey showed that of survey respondents who called the police for help with a domestic violence incident, almost 40% actually felt less safe after calling the police, and that 12% of respondents never even called the police in the first place because they're afraid the police will take their kids or end up arresting them or deport them or make a violent situation worse. This fear of police is disproportionate for Black and Brown women and immigrant women. So requiring evidence, including police reports, to use this law.
It doesn't have to be a police report.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a police report.
Okay. What else is included in that burden of proof?
Hospital reports, first person witnesses of abuse can be used. I mean, so there are like, you know, if you had a therapist or you did an outcry to somebody, you know, that is, you know, all things that can be used. We just filed April Wilkins' case in Oklahoma. It's a 425-page document of just witness after witness and testimony after testimony and doctors and, you know, police reports and rape kits and restraining orders. So it seems like everybody knows about it. It was crazy.
And yet, I mean, I just want to point out that even though April Wilkins is a white woman with mountains of evidence, like, I'm still on pins and needles to see, is this law going to do what they say it's going to do? Because if you look at Nikki Adamando's case, too, in New York, like, it all came down to that judge the first time that she tried to use it and she still got sentenced to years in prison.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's in New York. And I'm like, okay, Oklahoma, like, let's see. Like, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, am I on pins and needles? Mm-hmm. Of course. But what I will say is that from the very beginning, we've been willing to go to the mat on this issue. If I have to come back and change the law again and get another avenue, I will. But, you know, it's one of those things where I think what they're starting to understand is we're never going to go away.
Mm.
And there are a lot of women in your state and they vote.
Yeah.
And they don't want their daughters to die.
Right.
And they don't want to die themselves. And they don't want to spend the rest of their lives in prison.
All right. So, Natalie, Alex said that they are starting with 13 cases. April Wilkins is the first. You've heard of April Wilkins, right?
Yes. Yes. I have heard about her case. Definitely.
She's got a lot of media attention, so I'm not surprised that you've heard about it. After April, 9 more cases will be released at the end of September. So that's what's happening next for Oklahoma. Meanwhile, Alex is headed to Louisiana to work on a similar bill there. And she said, if anybody listening wants to work on a bill in their state, she is here to help.
We do have a model DVSJA bill with recommendations. And, you know, if you want to go down this rabbit hole, I will jump in the hole behind you.
Okay. So, Natalie, we've been keeping an eye on Oklahoma and this bill, and you even gave a showing of your film, And So I Stayed, at Tulsa Community College not long ago. How did that go?
The showing at Tulsa Community College was wonderful.
So one fan of your film wasn't able to make it to your showing, but she had already seen it because she rented it on Vimeo. And that is Amanda Ross, April Wilkins' niece. Amanda has been advocating for her aunt for about 10 years. She was only 7 when her aunt was sentenced to life in prison after she shot her longtime abuser, Terry Carlton, soon after he had handcuffed, beaten, and raped her. And I asked Amanda how she got to know her aunt, April, given the fact that she was in prison when Amanda was a child. Here's Amanda.
She would call my mom every Sunday, and I was eavesdropping the whole time, but it was every Sunday that was like the day we knew to expect a call from her after church.
Okay, so Amanda said that besides these weekly phone calls, she and her aunt sent letters and eventually emails back and forth. She said April was really caring and just a really sweet person. And she never mentioned her case and always asked about Amanda's life. Growing up, Amanda's family supported April. But the message that Amanda got about what happened was kind of confusing.
Even the narrative that my parents would tell me, like even as a little kid, was you know, she wasn't treated fairly by the system, but there was still this undertone that my parents believed she still did something wrong or wasn't as right about things as she could have been. And I think that that comes from living in the Bible Belt and just judging women. And that's not something that I stand for. And that that's also something like I've had a lot to unlearn. I'm 34 now and I'm still unlearning.
Back in 2014, April asked Amanda if she could make some copies for her. She was planning to try to get her life sentence reduced, but she needed some clerical help. And Amanda had access to a copy machine, so she made the copies. And on those papers that Amanda copied, she saw April's own account of the abuse she had suffered over the course of several years with Terry Carlton. Amanda had never heard the full story up to that point, so it was shocking and heartbreaking for her. She said around the same time, a producer named Dave Randag made a YouTube video of a recording April had taken of a conversation between herself and Terry. And in it, Terry admits that he beat her, that he raped her.
Hearing him admit it on tape, that was a turning point for me. And so as I was starting to question, you know, how bad was it? That came up. It's kind of funny because when you're in it, like when it's your family, you don't think to even Google things.
Because you think you have the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't hear that until my 20s. And I don't think my mom and dad had heard it either until recently. But it wasn't played at her trial either. I don't think the jury got a full picture. I know the jury didn't get a full picture.
Amanda said that all of that paperwork, that copying her aunt's story, it did not do anything. April's sentence was not reduced. That was 2022.
So yeah, that was very disappointing. But right around that same time is when Colleen and Leslie entered the picture too. So it really took off. It was like a domino effect after that.
Colleen and Leslie are lawyers with the Oklahoma Appleseed Center for Law and Justice, a leading force in the coalition that Alex Bailey mentioned.
And they didn't make any promises. They were very clear, like, we don't know if we can help your aunt. And she said, if we can't get April out, we can maybe help other people.
Given everything you're saying about all the unfairness that you witnessed firsthand from the state of Oklahoma, were you surprised at how kind of efficiently the Oklahoma Survivors Act, like, went through the process?
I didn't expect it, for sure. It's very weird. But looking back, Oklahoma is weird. We
stop there.
we don't fit normal stereotypes sometimes. How we have tribal governments that have to interact with Oklahoma, and Oklahoma also is very into those stand your ground laws, you know, and self-defense, but it didn't seem to work in April's case. So why doesn't it seem to work for women? But I think that this just speaks also to the fact that there's a domestic violence problem in Oklahoma that affects everyone across party lines. And at this point, I'm wondering who doesn't know someone who is incarcerated at this point because of our high incarceration rate.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $10, $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. The site is kpfk.org, and there's a donate button.
KPFK invites you to tune into The Global Village, weekdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., bringing you a global mix of hosts seeking the universal soul and making musical connections between our geographical and musical cultures. That's The Global Village, KPFK's flagship music program, with new and familiar voices, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right here on 90.7 FM and online at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and you are listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and for the world at www.kpfk.org. Support free speech and freeform radio. Peace.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
For me, as a paraplegic, this wheelchair is an extension of my body, not just a mobility device. And I think a lot of people can't grasp the concept that when you grab a person's wheelchair who uses a wheelchair all day, every day, you're grabbing their body.
What happens to a disabled body that does not produce at the rate of capitalism? It becomes ejected. It becomes labeled as deficient and inefficient against a system that is totally arbitrary and are absolutely external to the life of the body.
On today's episode, Disability, Our Culture, Ourselves, we'll take you on a bus ride in Seattle to experience a day in the life of a disabled passenger. And we'll hear from Sarah Acevedo, a disability studies scholar who explores culture and identity from within the disabled community.
When I claim or tell someone, oh, I'm autistic, and they're like, don't you mean you have autism? Because, like, you're human first. And so that makes me think what autistic people are inhuman inherently.
That was Professor Acevedo. Now let's hear from disability rights activist Dorian Taylor and the particular challenges they face while accessing public transportation as a paraplegic. Here's contributor Mona Ye with a report.
How you doing? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mona Ye. That was Dorian Taylor getting on a bus with me. We rode from Dorian's home in Tukwila to the South Downtown neighborhood in Seattle. Dorian is paraplegic and a wheelchair user due to a traumatic incident with police 5 years ago. Dorian moved to Seattle to seek better medical services and is now training for competitive sprint kayaking. Here's the dispatch.
To get to training, I travel from Tukwila to Bothell. It's about a 2-hour trip one way. I don't drive. Access is also very unreliable, so I catch the bus for everything. I do most of my own grocery shopping, go to doctor's appointments. It's my main method of transportation besides my wheelchair. For me, as a paraplegic, this wheelchair is an extension of my body, not just a mobility device. It was literally, specifically built for my paralysis level, for my sensation. And I think a lot of people can't grasp the concept that when you grab a person's wheelchair who uses a wheelchair all day, every day, you're grabbing their body. You're grabbing their physical person. I get a lot of that. Like, people will just grab me and drag me. Passengers, when I speak up about this, bus drivers tend to ignore it because they're just trying to help. And as a female assigned person, that puts me in a tricky situation because I've had people that weren't just trying to help. And I don't get the same amount of protection as anybody else. The chances are they're going to defend the person that grabbed me. We're not used to seeing people with physical disabilities be independent. That reflects on the policies of Metro, and it reflects on how somebody like myself, who is pretty independent and can strap themselves in and all this, it's how we're treated on the bus. So people don't act like I know what I'm doing. They act like they're going to know my mobility aid or how to strap it on better than me. I think a lot of people also don't realize how much these cost. This is $6,000. Just the cushion alone is $700. This seat back's $800. That alone should be a reason why a bus driver should just listen to you when you're talking about your mobility aid. An electric chair, you're looking at $30,000 or $40,000. I need this. Like, this is my everything, you know? It's considered damage to private property. It's not considered bodily injury. But if you break my wheelchair, I feel like you injured my body because you've literally destroyed my mobility. You've destroyed the ability for me to just go to the bathroom without crawling. It's really hard to explain to bus drivers that not every single chair is the same. Not every single wheelchair user is the same. Like, you don't have the same mobility as she does, so why would I have the same mobility and the same needs as the next person whose wheelchair is like you can buy at Walgreens? I've had bus drivers, I'll let myself unstrap myself, go up to the edge of the, to wait for them to put the ramp down. I've had bus drivers grab me by the chest, like I'm just going to roll off the bus while they're in the middle of putting the ramp down. And I had a bus driver literally tell me, well, I'm just doing my job. And I said, so your job is to grab people and treat them like children? You know, I've got left before to the point that when I used to catch the 120 downtown, houseless people would stand in front of me to make sure I got on the bus because they got tired of seeing me left. I've had a bus driver pass me up at the bus stop because he wasn't looking down. And then stop, but tell me I couldn't get on because he didn't want to let the ramp down in the grass. And this is the same bus driver that refused to tell a blind person where their stop was because they didn't have a white cane, you know. And it's such an issue. When I started working with the Transit Riders Union and reading the policies, well, the problem is in the policies. When they basically tell the bus drivers, you know, you need to make sure this person is safe, but there's never anything about consent. There's never anything about the person might know their safety better than the next person. When I lived in Portland, and when I was in New York City, you actually have the option of whether or not you can strap yourself in, because in reality, it's actually really dangerous for me, for my chair to be strapped in. Because if the bus gets in a wreck, I'm just going to fly out of my chair. If I was just locked with my wheel locks, I'd be fine. Like, that's how I rode in New York. That's how I rode in Portland. But here, it's actually really unsafe, and it's causing all of this damage to my wheelchair on top of it. Damage to the alignment, replacing screws and bolts and things like that. Your only other option, if you don't want to fly out of your chair, is to be restrained. That's where you got straps, so I couldn't even, like, grab what I needed to grab to take care of myself. So that's not an option either. The main problem I feel with the policy is they glance over it, and there's no actual training on how to interact with people with physical disabilities. And if you see the way people with physical disabilities are treated in our society in general, we're infantilized in a lot of ways. So the problem that we get with teaching it as an afterthought, and there being absolutely no consent in the policy, and the policy itself being really patronizing, is we have these different interpretations. So you have a bus driver that will let you on first, let you strap yourself in. You have bus drivers that lie to me and tell me that the policy and how you strap yourself in is completely different. Like, oh, you have to strap yourself this way and that way. Yesterday, I get on the bus, he strapped my tire both here and here on the hand rims. First of all, this is quick release. So that's like the most dangerous place to lock up your chair. So I told him, I said, oh, next time, could you not strap that here? Because just so you know, that's a really unsafe place to strap wheelchairs, especially everyday wheelchairs. And I showed him this. And then he started giving me hassle. And then I noticed that my wheels had been a little wobbly. So I was like pushing off the bus. And I was like, look, I'm the one that ends up paying for the damage. And these wheels cost $700. Then he tells me, you just tell me how to strap it up. And I was like, you know, actually, next time I ride your bus, I'll strap myself on, save the hassles. And he told me straight up, the next time you get on my bus, I'm not letting you on. And that's actually a pretty mild incident. But what had me call is I went to push up the hill and my tires are wobbly because they were pulled by here. These are $700 rims. I cannot afford new wheels. Because of how I end up paralyzed, I've got pretty bad PTSD and people grabbing me, you know, without my permission, it sets that off. So I'm not in a good mood when I ride the bus. And I have to prepare myself mentally to be able to catch the bus. And I have all my things on my person, like super close. I make sure that there's nothing that would even make anybody want to just reach out and grab me. Like, I try to make sure, like, everything's just in order so no one will touch me.
All right.
That's it.
Actually, do you mind putting him right here?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. That's where my chair folds down, so that's a hinge.
There.
Yeah, yeah. I got red tape on the one side and ran out on the other. Thank you. Uh-huh. No, that was golden.
We were fortunate enough to have a hassle-free experience on this bus ride. However, Dorian's reality is that every day and every ride is unpredictable. Before leaving the house, Dorian has to mentally prepare for the ride. Amidst constant healthcare trips, the long commutes from Tukwila to Bothell for kayaking offer critical value to Dorian's life.
I just needed something. I was going to snap. I was going to lose it. That's how I got involved in sports, and that's why I like kayaking so much, because it's the only place I can be where I don't think about all of that.
That was a ride-along with Dorian Taylor. Dorian is currently working on communicating with Metro Services to find ways they can better serve individuals with disabilities. Dorian is carrying forward the efforts of the disability rights movement that began in the 1960s and continues today. The main slogan of that movement is, "Nothing about us without us," meaning no policy should be decided without the full and direct participation of those affected by that policy. The story of Dorian Taylor was produced by Yuko Kadama and Mona Yeh in partnership with KBCS and Finding America. You're listening to Disability, Our Culture, Ourselves on Making Contact. Up next, we'll hear disability studies scholar Sarah Acevedo break down the powerful ways that common language and terminology can shape our perceptions of disability, and why even today we are seeing further exclusion of disabled people.
Everything disability is grassroots. Just think about that. Like, the history of disability rights in the first place is grassroots. Like, people climbing the Capitol steps, throwing themselves out of their wheelchairs, throwing their crutches, climbing those steps, invading, like sort of occupying, right? Those were people, everyday disabled people who were being intently marginalized from every aspect of everyday life. And sort of like how disability studies kind of was born out of those grassroots struggles and became institutionalized. As it so happens that grassroots knowledge becomes institutionalized and co-opted and sort of reinvented or reincorporated into this wheel of reproduction, not only in terms of like reproducing exchangeable goods,
we understand education as an exchangeable good, right? Which is a heartache. But also in terms of like this absorption of knowledge, knowledges in plural, turning it into this top-down approach to, oh, this is like the seriousness of the fact because we have put it in an academic book, right? And I am not whatsoever excusing myself from that because I am very much a part of it. I reproduce disability as anybody else who studies disability as a disabled person. And let me tell you, as a disabled person, I prefer to be studied by, obviously I want to study alongside somebody. I'd rather that disability issues are taken up by disabled academics. Let me tell you the truth. And as much as I wish, for instance, that I could go to therapy and my therapist was autistic, you know, sort of like entering. And so disability studies is kind of in this like sort of like sort of strategic infiltration space of like, let's legitimize our grassroots struggles and like sort of institutionalize them so that they are recognized within this sort of like matrix of dominant knowledge and sort of like ways of producing knowledge that are considered legitimate because they have a seal, because they're accredited, right? And in so doing, there is a process of separation of disability studies from disability grassroots struggles. Like, there's no doubt that that occurs. It occurs with anthropology. It occurs with sociology, right? And with many other disciplines. So, and I'm telling you all this because I want to talk about a model of understanding disability, the disability experience that was emerged from the work of disabled grassroots activists in Britain in the 1970s. And that they were working together. So disabled activists who were living in the community with disabled people who were still institutionalized and being brutalized and dehumanized within institutions of care for the disabled. So working in collaboration, they started thinking about the ways in which society disables different bodies.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. Or you can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. So Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $10, $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. The site is kpfk.org, and there's a donate button. You are listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
I'm Chuck Foster, host of Reggae Central right here on KPFK. Join me Sunday afternoons from 2 to 5 for 3 hours of the best in ska, rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central, 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday right here on KPFK.
Hi, this is Kurt Elling. You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and on the World Wide Web at kpfk.org.
Night town, lady bright, in the arms of
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
Right, so there's an active process that happens, and that process is called the process of disablement, right? So those are given fancy terms were brought into academia by disabled British sociologists, drawing from this experiences of grassroots struggles and brought it to bear onto this model that had prevailed the history of any study of disability. Not disability studies, that's different. Any study of disability, about disability, on disability without disabled people. It's known in disability studies as the biomedical or individual model of disability, which understands disabled bodies as inherently, individually deficient. So it is a problem. It's an inherent problem of the body. It has nothing to do with the societal circumstances, ideologies, practices, attitudes, institutional approaches to different embodiment, right? No, the disability is just a natural, organic occurrence, and it's a deficit. Needs to be cured, needs to be hidden, needs to be manicured, needs to be prostheticized, needs to be handled, needs to be observed in confinement, right? So this has been the tradition, right? The long Western tradition of understanding and managing and administering the disabled body through a biomedical perspective. That, unfortunately, is the perspective that continues to prevail today after 40, 50 years of struggles by disabled people, grassroots, academics, in collaboration, artists, performers, poets. You name it, there is still this understanding of disability from this deficit perspective. So these academics, like this British sociologist, were trying to be like, look, these people on the ground, they talked about a social perspective of disability, which locates the problem outside the body. It is not different embodiment. It is not the different body, different. That also in quotation marks, that's inherently problematic, that's inherently burdensome, or that's inherently abnormal, right? It is actually the social structures, practices, policies, institutions, interpersonal relationships that produce disability into a category of deficiency, and therefore a category of social oppression in every aspect of life, right? So in doing so, this battle sort of begun, right? It was like disabled intellectuals fighting against the rest of the world in terms of like this academic traditions and like schools of thought that had been like totally established in disabled academics and intellectuals, not even disability studies yet, but just like within sociology. We're like, look at us, we're disabled, we're talking to you. And the disciplines are like, you can't possibly be an academic, you can't possibly be an intellectual because you're disabled. So we don't know what you're talking about, right? So it's this power relationship and this imbalance between both two camps, so to speak. And so it happens that the social model has informed so many of our contemporary struggles. It continues to do so because it brings the idea of disability to bear on the material reality, concrete reality of the disabled body, of disabled bodies, in a way that we cease to exist within this platonic realm of ideas and narratives and metaphor, because disability is a very useful metaphor, let me tell you. For writers, oh my God, it's like the primer, like, let's go to disability and use all this imagery about collapsing societies through the image of the disabled body, right? In a way is to detach it completely from the realm of material experience. And in doing so, from our lives, from the very experience of disability, from living disability. So living disability is embodying disability, which we do, which disabled people do. We embody that thing. We celebrate that thing. We struggle with that thing. But in insisting on an erasure of disability and disabled people from producing everyday life and from producing the world, that's why we continue to circulate as metaphors, as charity cases are pitiful. That is not how we understand ourselves. That is not how we see ourselves. That is not how we represent ourselves. Disability culture, huge depth, vibrancy, richness, multi-layeredness of experience and deliciousness, and just like multifaceted ways of looking at our bodies in a three-dimensional perspective as opposed to these flat allegories. One of these examples in the Bay, like Be Proud, Sins Invalid, and Latif is part of Sins Invalid. It is this performance troupe of disabled artists of color centering queer and gender non-conforming experiences and bringing sexuality and sensuality in your face. Because the medicalized experience or representation of disability is the perpetual infant body, the non-sexual body, right? That is the mainstream that is completely dissonant with the way we live our lives and experience our bodies as pleasurable. We experience this body, our bodies as pleasurable. We experience our bodies as oppressed. We experience our bodies as interdependent. We experience our bodies as this huge amalgamation of greatness, of possibility, of hope, outside of this binary construction of the deficit and the perfect body. What is the perfect body? What is the able body? Doesn't the able body need the disabled body in order to exist? Doesn't it need to be constructed again, like in tandem? Like, how else do you define an able body? Everything that a disabled body isn't is the able body. So we're still needed. Like, the able body needs us, disabled bodies, to reproduce itself in this hegemonic, hierarchical way. So this division, like, think about the division between normality, quote unquote, and abnormality, which are both historical. They're constructs. Like, abnormality and normality don't just exist in a vacuum of like organicity, or that's just the way it is. Things are the way they are. Their white supremacy is just a natural occurrence of the hierarchical. You know, like, it isn't. It is a product of social relations that exist within very specific value systems and ideologies. So what I wanted to do today mostly was invite you to, like, really think beyond the binary. To just really dig deeper and look at the contradictions that exist, like, beyond, within, and the outside of those binaries that are so limiting and are so oppressive. So Another thing that I see so often with my students and just people in general, that's been like a really rich terrain of addressing this from the perspective, not of a professor who teaches stuff about disability. No, as a disabled professor who teaches about disability studies, is this an engagement with ableist language, everyday ableist language. So yes, metaphorical iterations, but in a more sort of like everyday sort of casual way. Oh, the weather is so OCD. That is an insane film. People don't usually think too deeply about the histories that exist behind the usage of these labels and these words. They have a history. Just as much as the construction of normality and abnormality has a history, these words that we use so casually in such arbitrary ways today, that's crazy, OCD, I was blinded by it, I was blind to it, it was a blind spot, you know, it's a crotch, the economy is crippled, which is not the same as reclaiming crip culture, let me tell you, that's a very different iteration right there, is there is a history. And the history is a history of brutalization. The brutalization of disabled bodies in the creation of nation states and the separation of bodies and stratification of bodies again in terms of who belongs and who doesn't belong. I mean, we can't give citizenship to everybody. We got to create citizenship in a dialectic with non-citizenship, because then how can citizenship exist on its own? We got to create nationals and immigrants. I mean, otherwise, what is the one doesn't exist without the other in this very dialectical oppressive tension, which is also a tension that produces resistance. The deployment of ableist language to create affect among audiences at the expense of disabled people. You know? So, yes, the histories behind these deployments are really torturous. They are real. They are part of a history that's been mostly erased from dominant understandings of the body. And those are the histories of the asylum in conjunction with the birth of psychiatry in the 19th century, scientific racism, and the production, the systematic production of these labels that would then determine humanity and non-humanity, humanity and subhumanity.
You've been listening to Disability, Our Culture, Ourselves. Special thanks to CIIS, the California Institute for Integral Studies, and the CIIS Public Programs Podcast for use of the Sarah Acevedo Talk. To learn more about CIIS Public Programs Podcast, log on to www.ciispodcast.com.
So you can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button or call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. So Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. So during this fund drive, and we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air, providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. And like that whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine. And that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. We love doing that. We love teaching radio skills like interviewing, engineering, and editing to young college students, to grassroots feminists from different communities across the city. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA, but we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening, to keep going, and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer. And that is amazing. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. And all through this past lockdown and pandemic, we have all kept going remotely for you. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. So we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Thanks to all our guests and contributors today. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
Escucha Contragolpe. Programa que informa sobre lo que realmente impacta en nuestra sociedad. Hablamos sobre nuestra música, costumbres, identidad, historia y política. Con una tónica diferente, ligera e informal, buscamos despertar la conciencia y la reflexión mediante el combate a la farsa y el llamado balance informativo. Todos los miércoles de 9:30 a 10:30 de la noche.
KPFK invites you to tune into the Global Village weekdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. bringing you a global mix of hosts seeking the universal soul and making musical connections between our geographical and musical cultures. That's The Global Village, KPFK's flagship music program with new and familiar voices, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right here on 90.7 FM and online at kpfk.org.